An 8-month-long investigation into Ohio's youth prisons and juvenile detention centers found that instead of safety and rehabilitation, incarcerated youth in Ohio faced neglect, trauma, and violence. The investigation by the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Columbus Dispatch, Akron Beacon Journal, Canton Repository, and others found the system doesn't protect the mental and physical well-being of these children. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. This hour, our conversation with two reporters about what they found during this extensive investigation. And later in the show, a dentist shortage and a lack of access to dental care is leading to a widespread problem of poor dental hygiene. We'll talk about a dental clinic by MedWorks in Cleveland this weekend to offer people free dental care. First, the latest national and local news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. A special 8-month-long investigation by several newspapers in Ohio took a hard look at the state's juvenile justice system and found that it's failing on multiple levels, from kids facing violence and neglect to guards being understaffed and fearful for their own safety. Instead of rehabilitating and educating these teens, almost half end up returning to the youth system or entering adult prisons. And those who don't return to prison face a higher chance of an early violent death, according to the report, which was published over the past weekend. Journalists from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Columbus Dispatch, Akron Beacon Journal, and Canton Repository contributed to the investigation, and this hour we'll talk to two of those reporters from this investigation. So let's have that conversation. Joining me now by phone is Laura Bischoff, reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thanks so much for calling in, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jenny.
We also have Amy Knapp, reporter with the Canton Repository and Massillon Independent. Thanks so much for being with us as well, Amy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And if you have any questions or thoughts about Ohio's juvenile justice system or this report and series, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Laura, let's first talk about the impetus for this collaboration between all of these Ohio newspapers. What made you all get together and dive into such a big topic?
To start, we're all owned by the USA Today Network Ohio, that's Gannett Newspapers. And about a year ago, I had been looking at conditions of confinement in the Ohio Department of Youth Services, and coinciding with publication of that story was the riot at Indian River, as well as the attack on one of the guards, David Upshaw. It was a really serious attack, and Amy and I collaborated on covering those two breaking stories on that front. And then just going into this year, we just decided that it was time to take a deeper look at what was happening both in the state youth prisons, but also at the local level in the juvenile detention centers, which are typically run by the elected juvenile court judges.
And so, Amy, the reporting talks about the idea that Ohio's juvenile prisons and detention centers are, you know, supposed to be safe places. This is seen as a chance to help turn their lives around before adulthood. But the reporting in the series found that these centers are indeed very violent, chaotic. Can you talk about the level of violence that you all saw happening in these centers through your 8-month investigation?
Sure. The violence ranges from, you know, just simple, you know, smacking, hitting, to, you know, much more violent attacks. And they're often very calculated and planned. And it's not just against the guards, it's violence against each other. And it's just, it seems to have been escalating recently, especially at Indian River, you know, with the Upshaw attack. You know, he is still a year later, he's still trying to get his life back together. And it's just sad when you think about it, that this man who was a veteran, who gave his time as a police officer, retired, and, you know, didn't want to put down his, you know, didn't want to just sit around, thought he could go and help these kids, and they've turned his life into a nightmare. You know, we're dealing with kids who come from troubled backgrounds. They don't, you know, they have committed violent crimes, and it's a powder keg down there at these facilities, with these kids sitting there, sometimes not getting the services they need, the mental health services, the, you know, education, the structure that they need to succeed, and they just don't have that.
So let's zero in on this incident that you both have referred to and really seem to be kind of the catalyst for you all thinking maybe we should take a deeper dive into the Ohio youth prison system and the juvenile detention centers. So what happened in Indian River? My understanding, and from what I've read, it's a 12-hour riot that broke out at Indian River Juvenile Correction Facility in Stark County. It left injuries to both guards and kids. Can one of you kind of tell me how that played out? And then ultimately, as you mentioned, there was a guard that was injured in this and now uses a walker and suffers from PTSD. So I know this is an extreme example of the chaos that are in these systems, but really an important one. So does kind of one of you want to iterate to me what happened there?
So actually, it was two different events in October of 2022 at Indian River. There was like a series of attacks on guards, including David Upshaw, who, as Amy said, he was a retiree who went back into the workforce thinking he could mentor these troubled kids. And Upshaw was working the swing shift. He was alone. A kid had rigged his door lock and slipped out and attacked him from behind, knocked him to the ground, beat him, but just pummeled him. He was really wobbly, was able to get up and call for help. The kid, who is now incarcerated in an adult prison, he took Upshaw's keys and let some other kids out. And that was just like one incident. But then like a week later, I think it was about a week later, the incarcerated juveniles were really fed up with these extended lockdown periods. And one kid was able to get, he was in lockdown, and a new inexperienced guard opened the door in response to a request for water. And that kid pushed the door open, took the keys from the new guard, let other kids out. And that's what triggered the 12-hour standoff. I don't think anybody was injured in that, but there was almost $300,000 in damage done to the facility. And it required a massive response. I mean, there were police, Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections sent its special SWAT team in, you know, and so that was very disruptive and, you know, pretty scary for the staff. If you watch the surveillance video, you know, the whole thing is just, it shows how things can go sideways really quickly.
Yeah. And I wonder, Amy, if you want to add to that about what other staff members said about working in those types of conditions and facing incidents like that.
Yeah. You know, it's been going on for a long time. As long as I can remember, I've heard from staff members talking about, you know, gang violence. They refer to some staff members being influenced by these gang members to allow them to do things. There's just a lot of, you know, unrest and just kids not following the rules. And, you know, they're understaffed, they're overworked, they're being required to work past their scheduled hours. And, you know, I think mentally, I think these guards are just really tired of dealing with, you know, some of really bad kids. And it's just taking a toll on them. You know, they're asking for the ability to be able to respond when they're being attacked or a child is acting out. You know, they were told not to touch the kids, and there's a different protocol, and things have changed. since these attacks, but they still say it's not enough. They still don't feel safe.
This is the Sound of Ideas conversation about an 8-month-long investigation that went on with a USA Today network of newspapers in Ohio looking into Ohio's youth prisons and juvenile detention centers. I am speaking with Laura Bischoff from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and then Amy Knapp, reporter with Canton Repository and Massillon Independent. Laura, let's go ahead and talk about these staff shortages. So how big is the problem? And also, you know, why aren't they able to fill these open positions?
Well, it's a really tough job. You know, as Amy described, that's they're working mandatory back-to-back overtime shifts. They are dealing with kids who are, you know, very traumatized and very volatile. And you know, a lot of staff are fearful. There's a chronic and persistent staff shortage. A lot of people might take the training, come on to the job, and immediately realize this is not for me, and they quit. I mean, I was talking to one guard who said that 2/3 of the other people who hired on with her didn't make it to the 6-month mark. And so they're chronically in hiring mode for security staff, but then it extends into the other staffers as well. For example, about 46% of the kids in DYS who are in school are on special education plans, so individual education plans, 504 plans, but 1 in 4 teacher jobs are open. So that's a big need right there. Likewise, half of the behavioral health jobs are open, and about 75% of the kids in the youth prisons require mental health treatment. They're on the caseload, and so that's another big hole in staffing. And so it we see it at the local level as well, and you know, you see it also probably to a lesser extent. But you know, like Department of Rehabilitation and Correction is also struggling to fill vacancies. These jobs, the youth guard positions, they start out at about $22 an hour, mm-hmm. plus, you know, good state benefits. But honestly, you could make that, you know, working at an Amazon warehouse. So, you know, it's tricky. I did talk to some teachers in the youth prison system, and they said that the signing bonuses and pay bump have been helpful in retaining teachers, but they, you know, they still need more teachers.
And do you think, I mean, I was struck by the employee turnover rate in your reporting. In Ohio's juvenile prisons, the turnover rate jumped 77%. I mean, that's astounding, from 2021 to 2022, leaving 1 in 6 jobs vacant. Do you think there is a misunderstanding for people who sign up for the job and then they don't realize, and maybe they think, oh, I'm dealing with youth, with minors, and think of it as kind of a softer environment, and then they start working and realize how exhausting and even potentially unsafe it can be?
Yeah, I don't know if they're going in on these jobs with eyes wide open. I would say that the youth prison system and detention systems are different than working in the adult system. The employees in the youth system, they face a lot of restrictions about how they can interact with youth. I mean, keep in mind, the juvenile prison system is not the same as the adult prison system. The focus is supposed to be on helping, you know, troubled kids turn their lives around and be held accountable. And the state actually takes on the role of parent.
Right.
So the state, the government, is responsible for the kids' education, their health care, their well-being. And so it's under very limited circumstances in which employees can use pepper spray or use force against kids.
But you know, the reality, Amy, is one of the juvenile prison employees you all spoke to, who chose to remain anonymous, said, "I say a prayer every day before I go to work." So, you know, the role of caretaker, educator, keeping these kids safe and moving them towards a path of rehabilitation seems like it's a far cry from, I hope I make it through this day.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Upshaw really thought that he could help these kids. You know, he admitted these kids did bad things. They needed to take responsibility for those things. But I think he thought that he could help maybe get them through this and get them on a different path. And, you know, he and his wife both said they realized there are risks to this job anytime you work in an environment like that. But he was not a stranger to that. He was a police officer. He was an Army veteran. He had faced danger before. And, you know, he told me one of the things, you know, they used to call him Pops, and they would joke and say, oh, you smell good. Where are you going after work? And why does your hair look so good and everything? And he said that these kids didn't understand the importance of putting on a good face, you know, and putting forth the effort to make sure you were clean and your hair was combed and cut. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he smelled good. He put on some cologne, even coming to work with these kids. And that struck me that a lot of these kids just didn't get those basic skills that a parent should be instilling with them from the day they were born. And for whatever reason, they never got that. And so I think, as Laura pointed out, this is a very different environment than an adult prison. There are a lot more things that go into this. And it's sad that someone who is going there to work to help these kids has to feel danger every day that they go there.
So I'm curious, let's talk about, you know, the system that ultimately leads these minors to these prisons and centers. I know that there are attempts at diversion, but how ultimately will a youth end up in such kind of a dire, prison or, again, a juvenile detention center? Laura?
Well, you know, Ohio does do a pretty good job of diverting kids. They have this program, Reclaim, that's been in place for a long time that really tries to surge resources into, other programs. It's almost like, you know, trying to build off-ramps. So as a kid is going down the highway, that they can exit and not get tied up into the juvenile detention and juvenile prison system, because the outcomes are so poor once you end up there. Even one night in detention can increase a kid's risk of failing classes and not graduating high school. But keep in mind, you know, these kids are, there was one report that I saw that kids who come in from the big urban counties who end up in the juvenile justice system, a third of them report that someone close to them in the previous 12 months had been murdered. And so that's the kind of trauma that these kids have experienced in their lives. And, you know, they come from very chaotic circumstances, and then they, you know, get into more and more violent acts. And so really our focus wasn't so much of what was, you know, obviously there are these conditions that lead to them into youth prison, but our focus was more on what happens to them once they are in youth prison. And because of the staff shortages, you know, they're having extended lockdowns, which is, essentially you're locking a kid in a room by himself, which is, you know, solitary confinement. And that is very, very psychologically difficult for teenagers. And also the fights and the lack of the neglect has had, you know, very detrimental impact on kids. One of the stories that we focused on was a young man named Demarion Allen, who's 15 years old. He's from Franklin County, Columbus, and he was in juvenile detention, and he was awaiting transfer into the youth prison system. And he was supposed to be kept apart from this other kid he had been fighting with. The staff failed to do so. The two fought. It was just a quick 10-second fight in which Demarion got slammed to the ground. He went limp. And then the staff members, like, he rolled him over, tried to pick him up, dragged him to his cell, dropped him on his face, dragged him down some steps, and then just left him in a heap, kind of draped over his bunk. That kid is now paralyzed from the chest down. And it's a bombshell to the entire family. You know, his life's never going to be the same. The life of his siblings and his mom are never going to be the same.
Well, that piece struck me because the mom had a job at Lowe's. She's a mother of five, single mother of five, and quit her job to care for Damarian. And as you said, I mean, I was just struck by, I mean, it was all in. All the kids are helping him go to the bathroom, making sure he doesn't get bed sores because he can't move anymore. And this is a 15-year-old kid who's never going to, you know, he's talking about missing his legs. And the piece was so well written, and it really struck me how, like you said, it's a bomb for the whole family.
He's got a really good attitude. A really good attitude, and he's worked. You know, he says his happy place is going to physical therapy at Ohio State. It reminds him of his days of, you know, playing middle school football, of like that kind of workout and focus.
Hey, we've got a couple of calls coming in from listeners. Todd's calling in from Cleveland. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, good morning, Jenny, Amy, and I think the other person's name is Ann.
Laura.
Okay, way off. Laura. So do you know what the budget is for any one of these individual facilities, particularly the one on Quincy Avenue in Cleveland? And if you do, do you know what the request is to raise the budget to what amount in order to better accommodate what they need to get done?
Thanks, Todd, for that question. I mean, I know you do, Amy, have some numbers about how much Ohio taxpayers are spending on incarcerating these juveniles, you know, again, with the intent that they're not essentially given a death sentence of becoming a hardened criminal or going into the adult prison system for the rest of their lives. How much are we paying to support a system like this? And is it about money? Do you think that more money is needed in order to make sure that this is a place of safety and rehabilitation?
Well, I believe we're spending about $100 million a year, taxpayer money, to support these prisons. And Laura, you might be able to help me remember. Was it $236,000 per inmate?
Sure. Yeah, at the state level, it costs $236,000 per year per kid in a prison lockup. We had varying statistics from the local juvenile centers. It's a little less than that, but it's still very costly. One of the kids I talked to, who's been in incarcerated in the youth system off and on for about 4 or 5 years. I mean, when I told him how much money they had spent on him, he was like, wow, I'm like the million-dollar man. I don't, Todd, I don't have any specifics about the budget for the local center on Quincy. Just in general, it's a very expensive proposition to have folks locked up. And also keep in mind that Ohio's recidivism rate is 43%. So within 3 years of being released from the state prisons, from the youth prisons, kids either return to the youth system or go into the adult system. And the state doesn't track what happens to the other 57%. But a study from Nationwide Children's Hospital compared incarcerated youth on Medicaid against never incarcerated kids on Medicaid and found a 600% increase in the likelihood that formerly incarcerated kids would die an early death.
All right. So let's talk about the impact your reporting has had. Certainly making a big splash amongst some of our political leaders in Ohio. Laura, I understand that even the governor has already responded to your investigative series.
Sure. Governor DeWine has appointed a panel, kind of like a little task force, headed by Tom Stickrath, the former director of Department of Youth Services, to dig into the issues that we outlined in the stories. There's no timetable for when they're going to come back with recommendations. The governor says he would like it as soon as possible, but he wants it done done right. Stickrath told me that he's going to get started, I think, just after Thanksgiving, to get some meetings together. The panel has a couple of retired juvenile judges, a juvenile prosecutor, a current juvenile judge, Chris Mabe, who is the president of the union, the state employees union that represents the guards, was kind of critical of the panel, saying that, you know, it's not broad enough, that they should have workers who are on the ground in these centers also represented on that panel. So we'll see. Also, the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate have called for an independent investigation. And the Corrections Institution Inspection Committee, it's this bipartisan oversight group, they've called a meeting for just after Thanksgiving, and they want to get some answers from the DYS director, Amy Ast.
And Amy, I'm curious. I saw an editorial board piece that was written on behalf of USA Today Networks. What were some of the priorities of actions that were asked for about how to make the system better?
Yeah, I'm trying to recall.
Or at least what are the reporters finding that needs to be done, and kind of what is the ranking of priorities as far as how to reform the system?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, we need to retain staff members and keep them safe. But I think one of the biggest things is that we have to take a look at, you know, what they're doing and what isn't working. They continue to cycle in the same people, you know, same leaders. Amy Ast has been in the system. Chris Freeman has been in the system. I think we need to take a hard look at those people and the policies that they are putting forth, and try to understand, you know, how we can help these kids, how we can get them on the right path, and how we can keep them and the staff safe. You know, obviously these kids need mental health help, and I think that has to be a top priority as well. And we're seeing that everywhere.
We have an email from Robert saying, being an ex-offender, I think the real problem is society thinking that locking up a person is going to rehabilitate someone. Laura Bischoff, reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Amy Knapp, reporter with the Canton Repository and Massillon Independent, I thank you so much for joining me, and well done with this thorough investigation into our Ohio youth prison system and juvenile detention center system. We have a link to the investigative series on our show page, which is ideastream.org/SOI. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break. When we return, we'll preview the 5th annual MedWorks Free Dental Clinic happening this Friday and Saturday in downtown Cleveland. That's expecting 1,000 people. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. Ohio is facing a dentist shortage, with a report indicating there may be as few as 2 dentists serving the entire population in some rural counties. Excuse me. Other barriers to care include transportation and insurance, as not everyone has dental coverage, including Medicare patients. And not everyone is aware of the recommendation to see a dentist on a regular basis. Poor dental hygiene can lead to a host of other problems for people's health and even mental health. Today, we'll talk to a dentist about the importance of dental health and preview a free dental clinic happening this Friday and Saturday at the Huntington Convention Center in downtown Cleveland. This is the 5th annual MedWorks Clinic, where around 1,000 people are expected. Joining me now to talk about his volunteer work there is Dr. Sam Taylor of Taylor Dental in Twinsburg. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question for Dr. Taylor, you can have your questions answered, and you can talk about your experience accessing care. Call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So welcome to you.
Thank you, Jenny. Nice to be here.
Yep. Let's go ahead and talk about this clinic. Where will it be and what kind of services will it provide?
Well, it's going to be at the Cleveland Convention Center. And this is, well, our fifth one. We missed a couple of years because of COVID. But we've been doing it for 5 years now, and we offer a wide variety of treatments. You can come in. The majority of patients come in and get cleanings, but we have cleanings. We have cleanings and fluoride for the kids. We can do extractions if you need a tooth taken out. We can do fillings if you need, you know, if you've got a couple of cavities, we can come in and do fillings. And then my section is we do temporary partials. We call them flippers in the business. But what a temporary partial is someone who is missing anterior teeth, and they, you know, just for aesthetic reasons, they want to have something in there so that they can smile, so that they can function.
Sure.
It changes your whole outlook when you don't have a front tooth. It is amazing to see the difference these patients when they come in, and we do before and after pictures, and how they don't like to look at you. They seem like they're shy. Mm. They kind of look away. They don't make eye contact when they talk to you, and you give them these teeth, all of a sudden now their confidence just booms. Now they can go out, they can go to a job interview, they can go meet the girlfriend's parents and not be embarrassed that they're, you know, that they're missing these teeth. And it's also kind of fun that it's right before Thanksgiving every year, and so these people are always excited to go home. I can't wait till my family sees me, you know, with that tooth back in there for the first time in who knows how many years.
Well, it seems like an extraordinary resource. You're expecting 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Who are the folks that are coming? And tell us a little bit more about the hurdles, maybe, well, due to socioeconomic circumstances, why people aren't getting dental care.
Exactly. There are a lot of barriers to care. The number one barrier was and always probably will be is money. That's the biggest one. A lot of people simply can't afford it. Then you have the language barriers. Some people, you know, just don't speak the language well enough. They don't know how to find it. They don't know where to go. Some people live in rural areas where there just isn't a dentist anywhere close. Mm. Everybody tends to have a phobia about dentists. I don't know why. I like to think that I'm a nice guy, but most people don't like going to the dentist. And so you hear stories and you're scared, you're afraid it's going to hurt, and so you're worried about things. The MedWorks tries to overcome as many of those as possible. We have patients that come in. They always try to do the events on or near a main route for public transportation so that people can get there a little bit easier. This year they made their flyers. They translated their flyers into multiple different languages, including Ukrainian and Chinese. So they have Chinese characters for the flyer. And distributed those things in those communities so that you can get more access to people. We always have a big influx of patients that come in from the Amish community. That's talk about an underserved area. There are, and we will get hundreds of patients from the Amish areas. In fact, I do see a lot of them because a lot of those come to see me because they're missing a couple of front teeth.
Okay, so we're talking about finances, not having the money or not having the transportation. What about insurance? Who has dental insurance, and where is that gap?
Well, the gap with dental insurance is that, unfortunately, dental insurance really isn't financially sound for you to get your own dental insurance. So people don't get dental insurance as a private person. The only people that really have dental insurance is as a rider on their medical insurance, is that you can get medical insurance usually through work, and the medical insurance sometimes will have a rider. It's dental and eye are the two, and they're both kind of the same problems. MedWorks also has a division that does a lot of optometry and that care as well. So that's another thing that MedWorks is trying to bridge the gap.
Let's take a call from Karen. She's calling in from Talmadge and has a question. Go ahead, Karen.
Good morning. I'll be really brief. I had a crown in the front of my mouth fall off. I do have medical insurance through my employer. Going to the dentist, they informed me that after my insurance, I would have to pay $825 out of pocket. They were unwilling to make payments. They offered me to sign up for a care credit program, which I was denied. So I started making phone calls to places that I thought would give me a payment plan. I've called Case Western Dental School. They would only see me if I was on Medicaid. Two dentist offices called Access Point, which is near my home. They would only see me if I was on Medicaid. So here I am, stuck without a tooth in the front of my mouth. I work with the public every day. And it's just very disheartening that, you know, I work really hard. I work 50 to 60 hours a week. I pay for my dental insurance, but I can't get the care I need because of income. I'm not asking for anything for free. I'm just asking, you know, someone please make payments for me. And it's impossible to find that.
Karen, thank you so much for your thought.
Yes, that's a common problem. We hear about that with patients all the time at my private office. Is you're right. A lot of the access to care problem is with the money, and even if someone's got insurance, it still which is the problem with dental insurance is that dental insurance pays up to a certain point, then they don't pay anymore. Medical insurance, you reach your deductible, and then everything else is paid. Mm. Dental is exactly the opposite. And so, unfortunately, many people are still stuck with, like Karen said, an $800 bill. And that is, you know, something, yes, you know, you do, you know, it's, you have to try to make payments as best as possible and make arrangements. I'm talking to the dentist now. You try to make arrangements with patients as much as you can to see if you can, you know, bridge the gap and try to accommodate some of these people.
So tell me how important it is to take care of the teeth and the mouth to the rest of the body. Oral health, I've heard, is a gateway to, you know, the overall body health. Is that true?
It is. It's been linked most commonly with heart disease and with diabetes. But the main link that it has with heart disease, especially, is the inflammation. That's the problem. Well, inflammation is a problem anywhere in the body, but the inflammation in your gums can lead to inflammation everywhere else in your body. And they have linked it to those two specifically. But yeah, that's what you want to do is avoid the inflammation. Now, eventually the inflammation can turn into infection. And infection obviously is terribly dangerous. It starts to bother your immune system. And you hear all these, you know, well, anecdotal stories of you know, the infections becoming fatal, which is only anecdotal if it's not you, but it's a, you know, that is a real problem, and you want to get it taken care of before it becomes an infection.
All right, so we're already running out of time, sadly, but what do you think are going to be some of the biggest issues that you all treat this weekend at your free clinic?
Well, the number one thing that people get done is the cleaning, so we're going to do more cleanings than anything else, but we're going to have a lot of extractions, we're going to have a lot of fillings, and I'm hoping we have a lot of people, you know, that show up, you know, people like Karen, that her specific issue is a little bit different than what we really do with the flippers, but hopefully we can get people who are missing, you know, front teeth. We can get them something in there that they can smile and make them feel happy about themselves. And so that's a big plus.
Well, fantastic. I wish you a successful clinic.
Oh,
Dr. Sam Taylor, dentist at Taylor Dental in Twinsburg. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Jenny.
And a reminder that the MedWorks free dental clinic is happening this Friday and Saturday at the Huntington Convention Center in downtown Cleveland. Time now to take another quick break. It's another episode of our music podcast shuffle. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for spending the hour with us. A young Northeast Ohio musician is rising the ranks in the jazz scene. On this week's Shuffle, IdeaStream Public Media's Amanda Rabinowitz talked with Ava Preston, who's hitting stages around the country and performing for her music heroes.
Here's to finding out the answers to all the questions you just don't know how to ask. Here's to figuring out the reason.
19-year-old Ava Preston recently performed her biggest gig to date, in front of a crowd of 4,000 at the Monterey Jazz Festival in California over the summer. She was part of the Next Generation Jazz Orchestra. Before the main event, she also sang for some of her musical heroes.
So we walk into the gala, right? All 20, like, students in, like, the foyer or, like, the opening. It's Herbie Hancock, and it's Christian McBride, Diane Reeves. I about fell over when I saw Diane Reeves, but, I mean, they were really nice people. It was so much fun to play for them. It's like a handoff to the next generation. That's what they were telling me. And they were excited to see where jazz goes, so I think that's the biggest compliment anybody can give you. The best part was probably learning that jazz is a very small world, and music in general is a very small world. You're gonna run into people again and again and again. And the most important thing is you do it for the music. That's what I learned. Everything is for the music. It's not for the ego, it's for the music.
Talking to you is like a game that I can't win. All these years is such a long time. God, I thought that we were close, but then again, I don't even know the real you. The conversation's mostly guesswork in the head. Wait for my call.
I want you to go back to when you were really, really little, because that's when you first discovered that you had perfect pitch. And it started with some Disney DVDs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. From what my mom says, I used to rewind the Disney DVDs on a player and teach myself all the songs. When I started singing them and when I started doing piano with a piano teacher, he recognized that I had perfect pitch, that I could hear the notes and understand what they were and name them no matter what pitch it is.
And you were what, like 4 years old?
Yeah, three or four, yeah.
3 or 4 years old. And then that developed, you moved on from Disney DVDs,
yeah.
Didn't you?
I initially found jazz in, okay, so you remember those iPods? I would scroll through just the music library that was on there, and I found Diana Krall, and that was my introduction to jazz. I'm like, whoa, what is this? This is awesome. And so I just started listening to it. I didn't start really seriously singing jazz till about seven, but yeah, I mean, jazz has always been in my life.
Ella Fitzgerald too, right?
Yeah, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan. I found Carmen McRae a little later.
What was it like trying to emulate them?
Difficult.
Yeah, I bet.
Difficult at first. I mean, especially the scat singing. But now I feel like I've really improved on that front, like improvising. It's one of the most fun parts of jazz to me, honestly, improvising. Because that's it's music about freedom, and it's very represented in the way that you play the music.
Footsteps that echo in the hallway, the memory of a moment that's passed and the words that I never could say. I see you standing, reflected in the skyline. With every little breath that I take comes the thought that you'd never be mine.
I know that you also went to a lot of songwriting camps. Is that how you kind of honed your craft?
The first one I went to is what inspired me to write songs. I did this songwriting camp with Steve Bogart at the Civic, and they told me to write a song, and so I wrote it. They're like, this is good. I want you to come down to Nashville. So I did, and I met a lot of mentors down there. I went to spring training, the songwriting camp, and it sparked something in me. It's like, I gotta write. That's what I have to do.
Pain inside.
I know in school one of your favorite subjects was social studies, and that influenced your songwriting.
Yes, I've always loved history, and I was learning about, you know, Malala and things like the Holocaust, a lot of wars, a lot of terrorism, and that really influenced me to write a song about genocide, is the way I put it, when I was 11. I wrote that song, Ashes, just to be a message of hope that there's something out there that is bad, but there's something out there that's gonna guide you, help you, whether it's a religious figure or just, you know, somebody who helps you on the street. Just there's something out there that's good.
It seems like the obstinate voices of wrong are the only ones ever heard. So you lie and you wait as your soul starts to fade, losing faith in this world. Oh, but I believe that your hope for a change will shine bright for millions of eyes to see.
And you wrote a song about opioid addiction.
For my generation, everybody's affected by the opioid crisis. Every single one of us knows a brother, a sister, a friend, a parent, an uncle, anybody who's influenced by opioids, and it's so unfortunate that it's that widespread. And I decided to write that song as a sort of wake-up call. Like, these people are hurting. We need to help them, not try and shun them to the outskirts of society, because one day it will affect you.
Drink until you pass out. Smoke until you're screaming. My sanctity is white noise. And peace is only dreaming. So maybe when the day comes, maybe you'll be sober. So pop another pill.
And all of those big topics that you've taken on in your songwriting, Toy Soldier, is about bullying.
Bullying is very, very near and dear to me, because I was bullied heavily for about 7 years. It was by everybody. It was difficult to feel like, and this is a common occurrence I've found for a lot of artists and creatives, you just don't fit in. You don't fit the mold. And this was a very homogeneous community in general. It was very difficult, but I feel like it made me the person who I am today, and I wouldn't do it over.
I gave it a shot. What more can I want? There's nothing left now. And those little toy soldiers that you sell when you're older, 'cause you wanna move on. When your play days are done, be the person you should have become. And I'm left broken and in pieces and parts of myself, hoping someday I'll learn how to fix them.
You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, some of the camps and songwriting camps that you've been to, and you mentioned one of the best is right here in Northeast Ohio. Tri-C Jazz Fest Academy director Dominic Farinacci, who's your mentor.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Tri-C is honestly one of the best camps that I've been to. The way it's organized and directed and the opportunities that we're given have really been like no other. We may not be the biggest camp or the most famous camp here in Cleveland, but there is so much love in that community, and everything I've learned about being a leader and figuring out how to do gigs, figuring out how to balance my schedule, how to just, you know, get through life in general, I've learned from there, and I've learned from my mentor, Dominic Farinacci. He's like a second father to me. Sometimes, like, we call him the jazz father in our circle of friends, but he's really been an influential person in my life.
When Dominic Farinacci was your age, he went off to Juilliard in New York.
Yeah.
Do you plan to follow in his footsteps?
I graduated May of 2023 from high school, but I did College Credit Plus with Tri-C, and I got an associate's degree before I graduated high school, and I'm finishing up my senior year in Kent. I'm applying to grad schools right now, and Juilliard is a very, very high contender, along with MSM and Miami Frost. And Berkeley, of course. There's so many great schools that, and I just want to throw my name in the hat and just see what comes out, you know? See who wants to, you know, teach me.
That's Ava Preston. You can find more episodes and follow the podcast at ideastream.org/shuffle. And we filmed this interview for Applause Performances, which is available to watch on demand via the PBS app. I'm Amanda Rabinowitz, IdeaStream Public Media.
2 a.m. again, I want a down a cup of antifreeze. I never understood through all the static on your old TVs. It stays the same size. I find 10 feet off a borderline cold on the inside. 3 a.m. again, I want to douse myself in gasoline. Strike a match and burn up all the things you ever said to me. The temperature that sets the start 104 and fall apart. Cold to the touch, but just close enough to try to tell whatever lies behind those violent eyes.
Shuffle is your backstage pass to Northeast Ohio's independent music scene. It's produced by Amanda Rabinowitz with help from Brittany Nader. You can hear episodes Thursdays here on WKSU, and you can check out all past episodes by subscribing to Shuffle wherever you get your podcasts. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter at Sound of Ideas, and you can follow me at JennyHamill_. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it is the Friday Reporters Roundtable with Mike McIntyre. This week, he's joined by Abby Marshall and Connor Morris here at the Idea Center and Karen Kassler down at the State House News Bureau in Columbus. Of course, if you missed any portion of this program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. Monday on The Sound of Ideas, another special installment of our quarterly program, Talking Foreign Policy. This time we look at how the international community is dealing with the ongoing climate crisis. Next Tuesday, we're going to bring you our annual Thanksgiving show with some area chefs. They'll be in studio to take your culinary questions, so you make sure to join us for that. Now I'm going to leave you with Ava Preston with her song Move Along. This is Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll speak to you again on Monday.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rood, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw, with technical help from Chris Dudley and Samson Auble. John Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.